If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Today on the WSJ Media Mix podcast, we speak with Quartz publisher Jay Loff about the state of ad-based digital publishing, Quartz's bet on branded content, and the dangers of programmatic advertising.
Welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast, bringing you interviews and analysis with people that matter in the fast-changing media business.
Hello and welcome to the WSJ Media Mix podcast. I'm Steven Perlberg. I'm here, as always, with Jack Marshall. Jack, what's going on?
Not much, Steve. I'm good.
So we've got, our listeners know the Wall Street Journal. They read us for our, excellent business coverage. And we're joined by an executive at another great business publication, Quartz. Jay Loff is here. He's the publisher. He's the president of Quartz. So, Jay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So we were sort of talking about, what to begin with here. And I'm sure you were sort of following last week. There was the news that Medium, the publishing platform, decided to pivot, as startups do, in startup parlance. And in this Medium post about their pivot, they talked about sort of like the death of the online ad-based publication business model. Yeah. And you guys obviously are an advertising-based digital media publication. So when you're kind of – it sparked a lot of hand-wringing. I'm curious, when you read things like this as, basically saying the business model that we operate in is dying. Does that make you nervous, or are you like not seeing that at all? And what's your sort of response to that?
Yeah, I'm going to forget. I don't know if it's an Oscar Wilde quote or whatever, but it sounds like, right, the news of my death is highly exaggerated or whatever the quote is. Yeah, I think, there's a lot of understandable reason for concern for companies that are ad supported, particularly, digital companies. But I think a few things. One is we're certainly not seeing it, and that's no spin. We have grown steadily for the 4.5 years that we've been in existence on the back of purely on the back of digital advertising. I do think that there's been a problem with really crummy digital advertising that has created some of the issues. And I would pose that when we started in 2012, and I don't gloat about this because we had the advantage of a clean slate in 2012, one of our early suppositions was, with this clean canvas to paint on, why would you go back and replicate all of the lousy ad experiences that had led to low CPMs, shoddy business models, ad blockers, and all the rest of it? So I guess the short answer is, I don't think that that there's a full death of digital advertising on the horizon.
So are you referring mostly to sort of commoditized banner advertising? In that instance.
Exactly.
Because Medium was following sort of a sponsored content type approach, which, I believe you guys do also.
Yeah. And there I would just say, execution is really hard. And I think Medium itself probably never went all in on that concept from the beginning, right? There are a lot of different models you could pursue with Medium. It isn't necessarily a pure play publisher in the way that we are. So I understand where there could be some schizophrenia around, which way do we go with this? And I think maybe for them, they made a smart decision. I do think execution, whether you're doing standard advertising or non-standard or content, is one of the critical components. And I think there are a lot of organizations that don't execute well.
So when you guys sort of burst onto the scene, branded content was kind of in its early days on the internet, and now lots of media companies, including the Wall Street Journal, New York Times,
sure,
have really delved into that more over the past few years. For you guys, how has that evolved as a portion of your business? Like, what percentage of your revenue does your branded content business make up now, and like how has that evolved over the past few years?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of our revenue is tied in some form or fashion to a branded content campaign, whether that gets fulfilled in the actually, billing against that content marketing, or is part of a larger buy that includes some display. We have sort of two simple options there. I think the main ways that it's evolved is we've taken the approach of the same approach that we've taken with our journalism, which is that branded content should have varieties of expressions that live natively, to use a wildly overused term, on whatever platform that might be. So the way the content from that we create for a client or content that they pay to run with us expresses itself in our app or in our email newsletter is different than it might be on QZ.com. And in some cases is very different on QZ.com, the desktop site, as it is from the mobile site. So I think the evolution for us has been as things have shifted to increasingly to a mobile world and various expressions there, we're very, very nimble at building for that.
You mentioned email there, which is something that we don't maybe talk enough about on this podcast, or perhaps just the industry generally.
It's just such a sexy topic.
Email. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's boring, but I know you guys sort of had a very successful email newsletter from early on in the existence of the site. How important is that to your business, sort of as both, a revenue driver, but also in terms of distribution?
Yeah, is it like Quartz's secret weapon, the email newsletter?
Yeah, if I had a secret weapon, I wouldn't reveal the secret, probably.
On a podcast.
On a podcast.
Not on a podcast, yeah, exactly. It's very, very integral to the business in a variety of ways, to your point. Is it the number one revenue driver for us? No. Is it a significant revenue driver? Yes. Is it a huge driver of traffic to our website? Actually, not at all. The way we looked at email when we launched it, and I think this is one of the innovations that has been since copied, is looking at the email product as a distinct product. So if all Quartz was an email product, what would that be? And so the innovation back then was what we wouldn't do is make it a marketing vehicle for Quartz headlines, and if we had 15 posts in that email, 14 of them drive you back to a story on Quartz. We thought that's actually not an email I would find useful. Rather, synopsize the stories so that you can learn from the email itself and link out to varieties of sources wherever those are. So that was the editorial innovation there. What it has done for us is created a sticky daily push product for Quartz that comes into your inbox every morning, and a lot of people almost conflate the two. I will run into people who know us will say, "Oh, I love Quartz. I get it every morning."
And that's their only sort of touch point.
That's their main touch point with it, exactly.
What's interesting, I think, as well, is like when you think about maybe the push to mobile or just the growth of that, is that if I'm reading an email newsletter, focus group of one, but if I'm reading an email newsletter on my desktop, I'm way more likely to click out and read the stories because it's pretty easy, right? I'm just like opening new tabs in Chrome. But if I'm reading a newsletter on the train in the morning, well, one, if I don't have service, I can't click out. But the other thing is it's just not as easy to navigate different tabs. So there is something to be said for just
scrolling through
and reading everything in that. I think you see that with like Politico and some other news organizations that do have really robust email newsletter businesses that have been successful.
Precisely.
Broadly, when you think about sort of Quartz's positioning in the market, there's like this conventional wisdom right now that you can be really, really big and go for scale, or be really, really small and niche. And Quartz is sort of in the middle. It's a medium-sized publisher. It's trying to reach a business audience that's not super niche, but it's not mass. Where do you find that that space challenging, and sort of how do you think about where you guys fit in the market?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question that not enough publishers actually ask themselves, particularly in a world in which it seems like there's been a lot of pursuit of scale for scale's sake. I would actually classify us as a niche in some ways, a very, very big niche, which was one of the bits of calculus we did when we decided to launch Quartz. So at this point, we reach more than 25 million readers globally across a variety of platforms. If you look at ComScore data, and maybe in this format, I won't cite all the people that fall below the line. Suffice to say, some pretty heady brands are now smaller than we. We are at the waistline of brands like yours, Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg. So I think there's still headroom for us to grow. We don't need to necessarily get to 100, 200 million uniques to be successful. And so I think we are laser focused on trying to serve the global business professional, which is our target audience. with our journalism, with the experiences that we provide from a UX and product standpoint. And then that is what attracts, I think, very, very successfully, a loyal advertising base. They know who the audience is, they know how you speak to them, and they value that.
What's interesting, I think, as well, is like you are one of the, I don't know, not only, but probably few business publications who are, you're chasing that sort of global business person, that executive that doesn't charge for your content. So the Wall Street Journal does, you know, if you have certainly a Bloomberg terminal, or maybe upstarts like The Information who are targeting sort of the business-minded person, are saying, you know, we're going to charge a subscription. When you guys are thinking about your business model, I mean, is that something that you see down the road, you know, certain premium options, or do you think that that's not the way that you guys want to go?
Yeah, no, I think, again, when you get into the niche of, you know, of business or global business professionals, you know, one of the other bits of calculus is that's a high value audience that also has the wherewithal to pay for things that get closer to a utility.
And expensive to their employer.
Expensive accounts.
And expensive, right, all of that, exactly. So, yeah, I think you could see a world, a place somewhere down the line where Quartz, you know, creates products and experiences that that consumers of our products and experiences might pay for. It certainly wasn't the first and foundational piece of our business. It is an ad-supported model currently. But, yeah, that's absolutely certainly something we talk about a lot.
So you mentioned sort of publishing across different platforms. A lot of the guests on our podcast are in businesses that are sort of following the distributed model, be that, you know, through Facebook or messaging platforms, Snapchat, etc. I feel like I see less of that from Quartz. Again, maybe that's just a focus group of one. But how do you sort of view the platform distribution sort of strategy and how that plays into, again, sort of the type of revenue approach you have, where you're bringing people back to your own site and sponsored content and some of that stuff?
Sure. Yeah, I think we're relatively agnostic about platforms, meaning that we don't over-optimize for any one. Certainly, we leverage them. You know, one of the early premises of Quartz was that in an ad-supported approach where you don't have a paywall, a regwall, we'll strip all the friction out of being able to discover and share our content on social media, which is how you go from an audience of 0 to 20 million in a very, very short period of time. So absolutely, we you know, work and publish and promote on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter. We haven't done a ton on Snapchat yet, but we're certainly in talks with them. I think the critical thing is just not over-optimizing for anymore on Instagram. We have not been on Pinterest, for example. I think it's just not over-optimizing so that you have all of your eggs in one basket, and when the game changes, you're left without a chair.
There's also like a certain, probably struggle with, you only have so many resources, to really focus on, you know, there are these new platforms and new things every day. Like, you have to, you know, have your Yo strategy or your Elo strategy, and then here we are like a year and a half later, and I don't think anyone listening remembers what those are. So
right. I still get email. Do I still get emails from Elo?
Probably.
I do.
To refresh your password, maybe.
Thank you. Okay, yes, I do.
Well, so yeah, so I guess that's a challenge.
I would say,
as well,
you know, I would give me and my leadership team highest marks for that over the first 4.5 years, is deciding what not to do, because there are thousands of ideas that start coming your way. There are a lot of things that sound great, when you put them on a whiteboard in a conference room, but staying focused. And back to your point, you know, just to rewind for one moment, the difference, I think, between us and some of these mid-level players that you're talking about is I would not want to be mid-size and be in the general interest space. I think you can be mid-size if you classify 25 million as mid-size, which I think is probably right, and be focused on a specific audience and serving a specific audience and being laser-focused, as we're talking about, and you can be just fine. But if you're general interest and you're that game's over.
Yes, it's a tough place to be. All right, we're going to have more with Jay. I'm going to take a quick break right after this.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Hi, this is Paul Gigot, host of the Potomac Watch podcast. Join me and my colleagues every week as we dissect all of the latest happenings in Washington. Check us out at wsj.com/podcasts and become a subscriber on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and the Google Play Music app.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
All right, we are back with Jay Loff from Quartz. We're just sort of talking about Quartz's strategy when it comes to platforms and how you think about it. Obviously, want to talk about perhaps the most important platform in the media business these days, Facebook. We talk about it a lot on the show. I'm curious how you think we just sort of reported earlier this week that Facebook is finally, some publishers would say, unveiling what seems to be their plan for monetizing video, the sort of mid-roll advertising. They're not fans of pre-roll. I'm curious what your video efforts have been like, because some publishers have sort of gone all in. I think you guys are a little bit more focused on more traditional, maybe text-based journalism and charts and things like that. But what's your impression of Facebook's video efforts, in the past few months?
In terms of Facebook's video efforts, I think, as you say, it's an encouraging sign that they're finally going to give publishers a mechanism to, potentially reap rewards for publishing video there. That's been our primary platform for publishing video. We do publish it on our own site. We publish on YouTube, but we're approaching 1 billion views of our videos on Facebook, and obviously not been able to monetize them. Our approach has been that it's really easy to do video poorly and to spend a lot of money doing it poorly. And then there has obviously not been a very readily available monetization mechanism. Almost every site, I would bet, including your own, can't generate enough video views on their own and operated for it to really be meaningful. And so these platforms provide a distribution mechanism that I think is really interesting. I'll say long before Mark Zuckerberg said it, when we first launched, we said we'll never do pre-roll on Quartz. I've said it publicly to kind of keep myself honest. So we share that ethos of not abusing users. So
what what's the rationale for that? I mean, do you just because it's super annoying and super interruptive and,
Yeah. I think there's a lot of lip service in this industry given to user experience, so it's become an overused thing. But we are, if we're zealous about anything, it's that inside our building. I'd say all 200 people distributed around the world that work for Quartz would say that user experience is the first thing that we think of. And so when you think about the experience of pre-roll, it's just a lousy user experience. And so we just won't do it. We've said publicly to keep ourselves honest. There are moments where I'm biting my knuckle over it, but that we won't do it, and we haven't. So,
but to be clear, you do have some video ads sort of in text or in feed, right? It's not that you don't do sort of video advertising.
No, exactly. We have video advertising. We've created our own player, so that creates a different user experience in video that has either user-initiated video at any point in the editorial video or post-roll. Any of the video that you see running on our site, as you say, that's video advertising, is all user-initiated. It is basically our display used as a video, platform. And what you find is that in the data is that the completion rates on those, the interaction rates on those videos is, much, much higher than you ever get from, from a pre-roll or post-roll situation. So I think it's that. It's a laser focus on the user. And my belief is that if you do that, the advertising works better. And at the end of the day, it's better for the advertiser as it is for the user.
We were talking about this earlier today, just me and Jack. Facebook has their video efforts been going on now 3 years. Zuck has been clear that he's not interested in pre-roll. Mid-roll is sort of diet pre-roll, right? I mean, it's still interrupting something in the middle of an. I mean, it's not quite as interruptive as at the beginning. It kind of seems like Facebook maybe spent a few years thinking about how to innovate when it comes to video advertising, and it has arrived at. Television, right?
Yeah.
You see some content, you see an ad,
spots, yeah.
Right? So, I mean, do you think that Facebook, I mean, they tried sort of suggested videos. That was another program that they had. That ultimately, this is there isn't some, I don't know, secret when it comes to video advertising that this is sort of the best you can do.
Well, I think that what they did before turning this 15-second spot on, though, also was allow us to do sponsored video content, which I think is a different path.
That is innovative and different.
Yeah, that takes you in a different direction than just doing, sort of commercial spots. So that was the first thing that they did. They might be limited somewhat in sort of the construct of their platform. I think a lot of us in the publishing world are doing really interesting things around video for clients. And maybe have a little bit more flexibility to experiment there than they do, which I think is interesting. The distribution is the issue, obviously.
So talk a bit more about advertising on your site, because we've kind of touched on it already. There's sort of a sponsored content element, but even the display advertising as well is what you could describe as non-standard.
Correct.
I don't want to call it native, but how do you sort of think about that? And also, how do you sell it? Obviously, a lot of publishers these days are selling programmatically through sort of automated sales platforms.
Right.
Are you guys sort of shunning that approach and going more for sort of the old school direct approach, or how do you think about that?
Yeah, so to this day, we have not taken a single IAB standard ad of any kind. That has basically, you know, cut us off of a programmatic solution, which I've been just fine with, because, and we can actually get into a discussion of some of the perils of programmatic. We are working with signed on a DMP that's going to allow us to do potentially some private programmatic, which would be building our own custom units. But the units to Quartz are distinct to Quartz, one, because they are, you're right, there's no way around this word, native to the experience.
But I feel like that's a good use of the word. It makes more sense in that context.
Than just saying, yeah, native advertising. So in essence, we offer you two simple solutions if you're advertising on QZ.com. One is the content marketing product, which we call Bulletin, and the second is an ad we call Engage, which is that oversized display that you see. And the way I used to frame it at the very beginning was, why can't digital advertising be as welcome as advertising is in the September issue of Vogue? And the answer I kept coming to was form factor. You know, if you have relevant advertising that actually looks beautiful, might be useful to you, and actually does not intrude on the experience, is consumed at your discretion, could be better, and so far so good.
I know the Atlantic, sort of sister company within Atlantic Media, has taken a pretty tough stance against ad blocking. I'm curious how you all think about it. I mean, it's more of a problem for publishers that are dependent on, as you mentioned, the perils of programmatic and sort of display advertising. But has that been a challenge for you, a business challenge?
Yeah, that's a really good question. No, not for us. I mean, for whatever reason, and I think, when I looked at it in depth a year and a half ago, there was a lot of in-app browsing that was taking place for Quartz, and that did not, that blockers were not really impacting that. But we've got a very low percentage of our page views that have suffered from ad blocking. So one, I haven't had to face that. But I feel two things. On the one hand, I stand with The Atlantic and other publishers around the approach of ad blockers, which I think has been disingenuous at times. There, some of the claims of extortion, I think, are arguably fair. Having said that, should we really be surprised that there are ad blockers? The ad experiences on most publishers' sites for so long have been so horrifically horrible. They interrupt. They slow your browser down. They eat up data. The idea that somebody might invent something that prevents advertising, when you look at the enthusiasm that someone with which someone discovers that there is an ad blocker, shame on us. And so I think I didn't think of it in the context of ad blocking in 2012. It really wasn't as much a thing. But I think the whole premise of Quartz from the beginning and the way we built advertising was to avoid the need for ad blockers. I mean, one way I look at it is advertising at the very worst that you are happy to tolerate and at best might engage you. I think, most publishers that I've seen in digital up until very, very recently, tolerate was the high end of that threshold.
So what about sort of revenue streams beyond advertising? I know you guys have events as well. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure.
Have we reached peak events?
Have we reached peak events in the marketplace in general? No, I don't think so. I think there's a lot of room for invention and different kinds of expression of events. Lord knows, we were just talking before we all got on air here about, CES. We have yet to see what virtual reality might open up in terms of,
virtual reality
the experience
events, right?
Of events. Yeah, right. Who knows? But yeah, it's...
Never have to go back to Vegas.
I would welcome the idea of never going back to Las Vegas. But... Yeah, I would say any of the additional revenue streams for Quartz have been secondary to the core approach of advertising. Just saying from the beginning, I mean, we've grown literally tenfold. Actually, we've grown tenfold in about every metric that matters, from audience size to revenue to number of clients, actually more than tenfold number of clients, to the size of the staff since we launched in 2012. And that's mainly in the revenue side, been on the back of advertising. So we've been, again, staying focused. We've been really good at executing there. I think over, you know, the coming 4 to 5 years from us, you'll begin to see more diverse revenue streams develop.
I know, I remember, because I was an avid reader of the TV business vertical that you guys had called Glass, and I think that you don't really operate that anymore, but I was curious if you see a lot of publishers now constantly spinning up new properties, whether that's on their own site or, like, we were joking about Business Insider launched a Facebook page called Insider Cheese. It's just basically cheese videos. So there's very niche ways to use this strategy.
Is that niche? Everybody likes cheese.
That's true. I guess, yeah, that's sort of a mass market play. But I'm curious if you think about other properties or sort of verticals or whether you think that everything should sort of operate under the Quartz brand umbrella on all your various platforms.
Yeah, it's a very good and sometimes complex question to answer, and it's one that we wrestle with as well. I think largely we like our product line sitting under the Quartz umbrella, but Atlas, which you may have heard of, which we launched last year, intentionally sits outside of that. So Atlas is a chart building and sharing platform that was developed out of our chart builder tool that was built in our newsroom and then open sourced on GitHub. And Atlas is really a separate and distinct platform for what I just said, building and distributing charts. We wanted that. We assumed that one of the use cases for that would be other journalistic institutions. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you all still do, but WSJ was one of the early adopters of Chart Builder when we first open sourced it on GitHub, as was NPR and some others. So Atlas is a tool that we think can be useful to some of our competitors as well. So there was a sort of strategic reason to not tie that closely to the Quartz brand.
Because competitors might be more likely to use it if it was named Atlas than after one of the competitors.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
But I think publishers, I think, do struggle with, you know, product sprawl. And I think it's a question that perplexes, you know, a lot of people in our industry.
Do you think it's just an audience sort of, just thinking out loud here? I mean, you see a lot of these publishers just spinning out, you know, as many sort of iterations of themselves as possible. And I don't know, maybe it's just a way to sort of inflate your numbers to an extent?
I look at it less cynically, at least for us. I think you do need to be constantly experimenting. I think one of the advantages for Quartz, one of the competitive advantages, is nimbleness. And so, and actually maybe going back and dovetailing off that last question, if you look at our app, which I get you guys have probably played with, which is the mobile app now available on Android, by the way, that text interface with the app, there was a lot of discussion about what do we call this? Because it's not full Quartz content or website. It is self-contained within the app. We decided to call it Quartz because we felt like that is what Quartz would be if it was an app. But I do think it's important to be experimenting because the way that users are engaging is changing all the time. It's changing rapidly and drastically. And if you get caught flat-footed, it's very difficult to recover. So I have no problem with lots of experiments being spun up. I think, you know, how you brand them, how you market them, how loud you are about saying that this is the new expression of our brand, you know, definitively is what you need to be careful about.
All right, well, I think we'll just have to keep an eye out for Quartz cheese. Is that?
I don't see Quartz cheese on the horizon.
All right, well,
necessarily.
You know, don't write it off. You heard it here first. Well, Jay, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the WSJ Media Mix Podcast.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.